Hello, everyone, and welcome to Iroquois History and Legends. I'm Andrew.
And I'm Caleb, and we are finally coming to wind this series down. This will be our final installment on the French and Indian War.
Last time we talked about Fort Niagara. The Iroquois Confederacy and the British have now captured the fort that secures the whole western frontier, and this has cut off all the other French outposts from resupply. At the same time as this, the British are launching a multi-pronged attack against Canada. General Amherst is leading his army to Ticonderoga, which is on Lake Champlain, to attack from the south, and General Wolfe is supposed to be sailing down the St. Lawrence River and heading for Quebec. When General Amherst makes it to Ticonderoga, he was expecting a pretty severe fight, because we've already seen a couple battles here on Lake Champlain. The French, however, decide to just burn the fort and flee up the lake. And they do this on June 25th, 1759, which ironically is the exact same day, hundreds of miles to the west, that Fort Niagara fell. As the French retreat, they also burn Fort St. Frederic, and this kind of leaves Amherst's men with no stopping place to resupply. And so Amherst isn't able to continue north in Canada, so it was actually a very smart strategic withdrawal on the French part. This kind of leaves General Wolfe's forces on their own. But Wolfe did have some help. Mainly, the Iroquois. Right before this invasion, Caleb, the Six Nations begin a total blitz of diplomacy. They start sending dozens of emissaries with wampum belts into Canada First Nation villages. These are Catholic Mohawk and Onondaga. These are Ottawa Nations, Abenaki, Huron, the whole works. Everybody you can think of. They're going up there and telling them to please stand down. If you're not going to fight for the British, at least don't make it bad for your towns. There are thousands and thousands of British troops coming, and we just want to keep you out of harm's way. The talks worked, and you got to remember, some of these Ottawa, Algonquin, and Catholic Mohawks literally live within a stone's throw of these French towns. So for the first time in 150 years, the French are looking at having no First Nation allies, and this is going to be their darkest hour. They even have the priests step in for the propaganda, Caleb, and they send couriers to the different villages telling them that this is a fight not against the British, but a fight against Satan himself. So James Wolfe is coming down the St. Lawrence River. He is expecting Amherst to come up from Lake Champlain to help him out, but he doesn't know that Amherst is stuck. He also thinks that he can probably get 12,000 troops to go with him on this expedition, but he only gets about 7,000 regular troops with 400 officers and 300 gunners. A little more than half of what he was expecting, three quarters. To lead all these men, he's got a fleet of 49 ships and 140 smaller craft. And the person that's preparing the fleet's approach is a guy named James Cook. Have you heard of James Cook before, Caleb?
It sounds familiar.
Famous British sailor, helped discover like Australia, New Zealand, and dozens of other Polynesian islands. That James Cook. His job was to survey a large portion of the river, because at the time the St. Lawrence River is just filled with islands and rapids and tides and all kinds of swirling water. This is long before they made it into an actual seaway like they did today.
There were tides in the river?
Yeah, because the river is so big that the ocean tide comes in and out even way inland.
No kidding.
Yeah, so yeah. It's very tricky to traverse the water, especially with a whole armada of smaller vessels. Cook's ship was the first one to sail up the river, and he's sounding the channel as he goes.
So Wolfe and his armada land just on the east side of the St. Lawrence River, directly across from Quebec, on an isle called Île Orléans. They landed there basically because it was the only place they could. It was literally the only undefended branch of the St. Lawrence near the city of Quebec. So the French try to take advantage of the English ships being all bottled up because they are all stationed, they're all docked right there, right where the St. Lawrence River splits into a Y. So they decide they are going to light some ships on fire and they are going to steer them directly into this whole armada in the middle of the night. And once this happens, it would trap all the English forces on the opposite side of the river, therefore completely stalling the campaign for at least another year, most likely several years, because it's actually quite difficult to build a whole fleet of 50 ships, especially under the logistical situation that the French and the English have at the time. The plan almost actually worked, but the French waited slightly too long to light the boats before abandoning ship, and this gave the English just enough time to paddle out there quickly, climb on board, and steer the fire ships away from the fleet. General Wolfe begins bombarding Quebec, and he's basically trying to draw Montcalm out. He's in there, and we may have mentioned this before in other episodes, but the city of Quebec is a fortress.
It's a citadel.
It's protected by cliffs and walls and rivers. Montcalm, he's no fool. He's going to take advantage of his high walls and his river, and he's not going to take this bait that General Wolfe is throwing his way when he lives inside an impregnable city. At least a city that he thinks is impregnable.
Spoilers.
General Montcalm's refusal to come out and fight forces General Wolfe to stage an attack at a French position at Montmorency Falls, about 4 miles north of the city. And this attack fails horribly.
Because, of course it did, because the British seem to suck over and over again.
He sent troops across in little bateaux. They crossed the river. They landed there. The French had the high ground. They had walls set up. And the English were pinned between a waterfall, a river, and a cliff. And it just went horribly wrong, and the English troops were forced to surrender. So on September 13th, 1759, Wolfe orders his troops to load into small boats again. I wonder if the soldiers are thinking, oh no, I hope this isn't going to be like the other day. Under cover of darkness, and they float quietly past the city. And they land at some cliffs protecting the west side of Quebec. Wolfe's men begin climbing the steep cliff in the middle of the night. And the French had very few men stationed there because it was basically thought to be impossible to climb the steep cliff with an army.
How high are these cliffs?
That's a great question, Andrew. It's actually 53 meters these cliffs were. What's that in feet?
174.
174 stinking feet.
I don't want to climb that.
Me neither. So Wolfe's men began climbing this steep cliff in the middle of the night, and the French had very few men stationed there because it was basically thought to be impossible to climb that steep embankment with an army. So throughout the night, as more and more men are reaching the top, whenever you get lots of people together, even when they're being quiet, it gets louder and a little more noticeable. So after you get a few hundred people up there, there was enough noise to actually alert a sentry that was nearby. The sentry yelled, "Who is up there? Identify yourself." Something like that. That's my French accent. He probably said it in French, though, not in English. One of the British soldiers was named Donald McDonald.
You can't make this stuff up.
And somehow, we don't know where, but he was fluent in French. So he quickly whispers to everyone to shut up. And then he replies to the sentry in perfect French, "We are French under orders to keep an eye out on this cliff." And apparently that explanation was enough for the French soldier, and he just said, "Oh, okay," and turned around and walked away.
Does this guy get fired? Or hung?
Well, luckily, I think all of his bosses are going to be dead, so he will never get blamed for it. He is an unidentified French sentry in the story, so it's probably best for his sake that he was unidentified. Who was patrolling that last night? Not me. So all night long, the English continue to climb the cliff, and they take the position without a shot. As the sun rises on September 14th, the English army looks out, and they see just a beautiful open field that would go down in history.
What was the field called?
It was a huge field, Andrew, and it was owned by a man named Abraham Martin. And today we know it as the Plains of Abraham. It does sound more poetic, the Plains of Abraham, as opposed to the farm of Abraham Martin.
Yeah, I guess that does sound better.
As the British begin to march on the city, word comes to Montcalm that the English were at Abraham Martin's farm. And General Montcalm, seeing that the messenger was a Scot, dismisses him as being a drunk. That's kind of an offensive stereotype, General Montcalm. And Montcalm said, basically, no one could climb those cliffs, let alone a whole army in one night. But then all of a sudden, a few minutes later, more messengers come and they confirm the news. Now, throughout the last year of this war, Montcalm knew that it was only a matter of time before the French were defeated, and he was constantly writing and begging the French government to come to terms with the English. And near the end, he wrote to the French powers that under any conditions, you need to submit to the English, because otherwise we're going to lose all of Canada. And so that was one of the main reasons why he was stalling in the city and not trying to fight. He actually had an army that was far superior in size to Wolfe, but they weren't well supplied and they weren't well trained, and they were all, their morale was low at this point. They had just lost all these major battles and they were down to just their capitals, basically, of Canada. But his time had run up and he could no longer hold in the city any longer. The city was a lot weaker from the direction of Abraham's farm, so Montcalm decided it's time to march his army and meet Wolfe and let the straws fall where they do. He ran into a problem right away, being that most of his men were stationed 4 miles north of the city, and they were put there to slowly advance after the English, if you remember, a few days earlier had attacked Montmorency Falls. So he had all his men 4 miles north to protect in case they try and attack there again. So he orders his men to run nearly 3 miles in full gear to the Plains of Abraham. Wolfe had ordered the English to stand in lines of 2 deep as opposed to 3 or 6, as they normally did in a lot of these armies at the time. This gave his army the appearance of being much bigger than it really was. When the French arrived, they saw the English lines reaching all the way across the plains, more than a mile long, shoulder to shoulder.
So the saying that a mile wide and an inch deep is actually literal in this sense?
It literally was, but he was playing more psychological warfare here than he was at actually working well. But the French advanced, and you got to remember, they just ran 3 miles from a couple miles north of the city to a couple miles just west of the city. And then they get there and they see this huge English army. They're winded and scared. And as they're marching towards the English, and the English are just standing their ground, they begin to fire. And not fire in like a volley, but everybody just begins to open fire. And they are over 100 meters away.
So very few bullets are even going to make it that far.
Exactly. But the English, even though they only had about half the men of the French, they were all commissioned redcoat soldiers. 7,000 of them, if you remember.
To add insult to injury, about 300 native warriors, mostly Ottawa, but some other native allies, were still loyal to the French and had been with them rushing over here to help. But as soon as they saw that this battle was going to be taking place in a plain, they said, we're just going to be up front with you guys. We do not do this. If you guys want to shoot each other in formation in an open plain, go right ahead. If you need help, we'll be off here on the sides as auxiliaries, but we're keeping out of this.
The English held their line and waited in perfect discipline. And when the French were only 40 meters away, they opened fire all at once, like one shot, all 7,000 of them. Then they reloaded and did it again. A bullet whistled through the line and it struck General Wolfe right as the French line was beginning to break. He fell to the ground and a yell came up that, "They are retreating!" Wolfe asked, "Who is retreating?" And they said, "The French." And Wolfe is quoted saying, "Praise God. Now I can die in peace." He then turned his head to the ground and died.
So the British have just lost their general.
Normally, this could be a point where the battle can turn in your favor.
Yeah, because the French have Montcalm, and he's a very famous general. So even though the French are retreating, he can surely regroup them and rally them, right, Caleb?
As the French were pursued to the city, Montcalm was struck off his horse by a musket ball.
Uh-oh.
3 men carried him to the safety of the city, and a surgeon looked him over, and that he told him that he would not live through the night. Montcalm ordered a pen and paper, and with his last ounce of strength, he signed a letter to General Wolfe, submitting his surrender, and died 5 a.m. September 14th. A cannonball had tore through the church nearby and created a crater, and his colleagues thought that this would be a fitting place to bury their longtime leader and the defender of New France, and he was placed in the crater and buried inside the church crater at 8 a.m. that morning. Once Montcalm was buried, his other senior staff basically looked to the defenses of the city, and they positioned people on all the walls, and 3 days later, they put up the white flag, and they surrender Quebec to the English, leaving one final stronghold,
which would be Montreal. So the total casualties for this expedition, including all the landings and the Battle of the Plains of Abraham, were pretty even, actually. The French had 644 men killed or injured, and the British had 658 killed or wounded. But when your city's totally surrounded, it doesn't matter if you came out even on the casualty number. So now the British not only have taken Quebec, but now they've taken it without destroying it, so they have a castle there also. People in Montreal now are pretty desperate. They're totally cut off. Montreal is very far inland. And the fortunate thing is they still have a lot of troops stationed there. And fortunately also, they had a bountiful harvest, so they have a lot of food. And so they're thinking in the spring, the following year, in 1760, we're going to try and retake Quebec. One of the Mohawk that lived near Kanistaki heard the French expedition was heading that way, and he said, if they don't succeed in their last effort against Quebec, it's all in vain. There's not going to be any further opposition after this. He sees the writing on the wall, realizing that the French are toast. They're finished. If they don't take this city by some miracle, it's all over. So what is known as the Battle of Sainte-Foy was actually a big victory for the French. The French general in this battle was a man named Chevalier de Lévis, and he fought a battle against the British General Murray. And it was actually bloodier than the Battle of the Plains of Abraham. In this conflict, we had 833 French casualties to 1,124 British. Unfortunately, this is going to be the last French victory in the French and Indian War, because even though they fight this battle outside Quebec, once they get to the citadel with the walls, they kind of just sit outside and they're like, yeah, we have no way to take this. Even our cannons are useless against the walls. And they camp there for a little bit. The French are just sitting outside. It's early spring. The snowdrifts have melted. It's a muddy bog everywhere. The French general hears that ships are coming. And he's thinking, okay, great. There's ships coming down the St. Lawrence River. They're sending supplies from New France. We're going to be all right. We can hold them out. We can be resupplied here and take as long as needed to take this city. But guess what ships they were, Caleb?
I'm guessing English ships.
They were English ships. The French say, all right, that's it. They packed up, turn around, and headed back to Montreal. So again, as we mentioned, Montreal is now totally on its own. General Amherst decides that he is going to take Montreal and end this war in North America once and for all. But to do that, he's going to need some help. He needs the Iroquois to work through diplomacy again to really make sure that none of these Native Americans up in here are going to give any trouble. Because he realizes he has enough men to take Montreal, but what he doesn't have is enough men or enough time to attack every single Native American town and settlement in Canada. So in the summer of 1760, an Onondaga warrior named Okwegatete comes down and meets with William Johnson and British forces. Now this guy has been playing both sides of the French and British whenever it has suited his Onondaga nation the best, which any patriotic person would do for their own home country. So during the war, sometimes he's helping the British scouting out a different area up in Canada. And other times he's taking the French down to German flats and attacking there. But he realizes that it would now be in the Onondaga best interest if everybody, all of the Native Americans in Canada, came over to the British side to make sure that no Native blood is spilled. William Johnson is negotiating furiously with different people, and many of these Northern Canadian Mohawks and Onondaga are coming down from Canada all the way to Onondaga, to Oswego, to Johnson Hall, and working out ahead of time to get this all set up. So when General Amherst finally gets his army to Oswego to head up to Montreal, when he got there, there's 1,330 Iroquois from both New York and Canada there waiting for him. And so they hold a council of what they're going to do. In the end, they commit 706 warriors for the invasion, and they join Amherst on the ships, traveling north up the St. Lawrence River and land at Oswegatchie, which is modern-day Ogdensburg. It's right on the border of the St. Lawrence River where New York and Canada are. At the time, Oswegatchie is a massive Onondaga town of about 3,000 Native people. Most of these have relocated from central New York up into this area to be closer to their Catholic brothers and sisters. So when the British forces land at Oswegatchie, there's a bit of a problem. Despite assurances from the British to the Oneida and the Mohawk and the Onondaga that all of the Canadian villages will be left alone, when the British troops land here, they see a lot of these houses that look very colonial in the French style, and they see churches around. And so they instantly begin raiding them and burning them.
Because everybody knows that you don't attack your Indian allies, but if they happen to have French people living amongst them, they're free game for pillage.
But the problem was, these were not French houses at all. These were the native houses, and they had styled their buildings in the French style.
This is probably one of the first documented times where you start to see Native Americans living in towns built in colonial styles. I don't remember ever seeing it before in any of my readings.
It's a slow change that starts to happen. We'll see it more during the American Revolution, which we'll probably talk about in the future, that many Iroquois people start living in single homesteads versus these long houses with communal dwellings. So all these Oswegatchie Onondaga Christians that think that they're here to help the British have had their town destroyed. Thanks, but no thanks. I'm so glad we came over to the British side. Amherst's men are finally stopped once a guy comes to the general and says, look, these are our allies, please don't do this. But by the time they were done, there was almost nothing left. So they continue their march up the St. Lawrence River. As the forces are traveling down the St. Lawrence River, the Mohawk and the Onondaga are sailing towards Île-la-Chevelle.
The Onondaga and the Mohawk are sailing? They have sailing ships now?
Well, it's not the Onondaga warriors or the Mohawk warriors per se. The British have acquired some ships named the Onondaga and the Mohawk.
Okay. I was thinking to myself, man, things are moving along really quickly now.
So they go upstream from Fort Lévis, and the Onondaga and the Mohawk ships are pursued by a French row galley. But you know what this region's called, Caleb?
No.
It's called the Thousand Islands.
Ah.
And you know what the problem with having thousands of islands all around is when you're being pursued by different ships?
Well, a lot of these islands are about 6 inches under the water.
And it's a maze. And so the Onondaga and the Mohawk actually get lost and can't make it back to where the battle and the siege of the fort actually are for several days. I'm not going to go into details, but there's a lot of really cool naval battles, and French put up a very stern resistance. The guy commanding Fort Lévis is a guy that you may remember, Caleb. Do you remember who Pouchot is?
General Pouchot.
Yes.
Yeah.
At Fort Niagara?
Yeah. This little rascal's still alive?
He's still alive. And he gets put in the awkward position of having to defend the siege here. And what makes it worse is he actually gets wounded. And he has to surrender again and be a prisoner of war again. But the British were very surprised at such a spirited resistance. Amherst's forces remain here for about 4 days, and then they're on again towards Montreal. The British, again, this river is really dangerous, lots of rapids. He loses another 84 men just drowned in the river. Although when Pouchot writes home to France, he says that the British lost 336. So take your pick. At the same time, other forces are coming down from Quebec and coming up from Lake Champlain, and they've surrounded Montreal, and they all meet together at the same time. So you have Iroquois and three British armies all here, forces totaling 17,000 men converging on Montreal.
Is this the largest army up until now?
We say that every time, so yeah, it probably is again. So just absolutely... this is overkill. The English do not need this many men. But they've seen the French beat them again and again and again with far smaller numbers. And this time they're not taking anything for granted. They converge on the town. They burn any side suburb village. And they begin mass deporting any Canadian militia that they capture. On September 8th, Montreal is totally surrounded. And the French governor, the Marquis de Vaudreuil, surrenders to avoid any further bloodshed.
In the surrender, they actually end up agreeing that any non-personnel or non-military personnel will be granted permission to stay, and they can, all the tradesmen and the farmers can stay in Canada and continue to live there in peace, which is why we still have French Canada to this day.
And another one of the stipulations in the surrender at both Quebec and here was they wanted to make sure that they would not be persecuted for being French Catholics, because they wanted to make sure that their religious beliefs and practices would be able to stay in place. And which is funny because the British absolutely hate Catholicism and all that it stands for, but they said yes. And again, that's why you still have many French Catholics in Montreal and Quebec region to this day. With the surrender at Montreal, this is the functional end of the war in North America. A few weeks later, on September 15th, the British knock on the door at Fort Detroit, tell them that it's over. Detroit surrenders, the British flag goes up, and things become quiet again. One little hiccup a couple years later in 1762, the French launch an expedition to try and take Newfoundland. It goes nowhere, totally fails. That's not to say that the French and British aren't fighting everywhere. They're obviously fighting over in Europe and in Asia and Africa at the time.
If I remember correctly, I think they needed Newfoundland because they have so many fishermen there, and they need a place to land and dry their fish before sending them back to Europe. So it was crippling their fishing economy, not having anywhere to do that. So I think after this failed attempt, they ended up signing some deal with England where they got some island somewhere up there.
And yes, I'm going to mention those islands.
Oh, okay. I just vaguely remember reading about it.
Yeah, very interesting. The following year, February 10th, 1763, the Treaty of Paris. Don't Google Treaty of Paris because there's about 75 of them. And the French cede all possessions east of the Mississippi River, except for New Orleans, are given to the British. And all French possessions west of the Mississippi River are given to the Spanish. The French do regain, because you mentioned this, Caleb, some tiny small islands called Martinique, Guadeloupe, and Saint Lucia. Those three islands are in the Caribbean. But then up just off the tip coast of Newfoundland are a group of smaller islands called Saint-Pierre and Miquelon. And those little group of islands there are still retained by France to this day. They never really lost all of North America. That being said, these islands are taken over back and forth every single time the French and British had a war for the next couple hundred years.
Another kind of interesting note about all of these islands we're mentioning, and I don't think we've mentioned it throughout the show, but the French leadership throughout the war has commented on how one of these islands turns more profit than the entire inland of North America and New France, Canada. So a lot of the people were actually saying, just stop sending money in there. Let's just keep our sugar islands and keep our fishing islands because those actually help our economy and bring us goods and forget about Canada.
And it's actually true. After the war is over, the French start running a surplus, making more money off these few groups of islands than the money pit that they had in all the wilderness forts. Another thing that comes out of this treaty is the British government legitimately thinks that they're going to help the Native Americans, and they set up what's known as the 1763 Proclamation Line. If you remember back a few episodes when we talked about the Treaty of Easton, how the Quaker Assembly wanted to have a firm border that would be on one side where the settlers were, and everywhere in the interior of the continent would be left for the Native nations. This is what they petitioned, and they got it. And so the British government sets anything on this line, pretty much all land west of the Appalachian Mountains, as a reserve for all the Native American nations. And the problem was solved, and no colonials ever went past the mountains ever again, in a perfect world. So the British and the Iroquois won, right, Caleb? So now the Iroquois Confederacy must be the most powerful Indian nation ever, correct?
Yeah, in a lot of ways, this is going to have many, many different negative impacts on the Iroquois and other Eastern Native Americans. The Iroquois, at least for the past 150 years, have been profiting on the fact that they're being wooed by the French and the English. So they both have to constantly be giving them more gifts and giving them better deals. But now that the French are gone, the English have the monopoly that all of the Native Americans need, and this is going to put them over a barrel. And it's also going to have a lot of other very negative impacts, and one of them is just on their society and their culture at this point is really going to start deteriorate due to things like disease and alcoholism.
Big thing are those two. Diseases are even more rampant now than ever before because you've had all these armies moving around for years and warriors going here, warriors going there, British armies marching through, and everything from measles to smallpox, diphtheria, cholera, the common cold has just been wreaking havoc all over North America. Alcohol is a worse demon though. And the problem is it doesn't kill you, it destroys your entire society. British traders are starting to realize, and it's been going on for, like Caleb said, 150 years. This is nothing new. The British people and the French people and the Dutch people had been using alcohol to manipulate people for long before this. But now that the British can set the price on whatever, they know that the Native Americans are hooked, men and women, on having the next drink. And anybody that knows somebody in a family that has been affected by somebody who suffers from alcoholism knows that nothing else matters except getting that next drink, satisfying that need to quell your depression or whatever that hole is in your life. And you see families even to this day that are destroyed by this, whether it's drunk driving or poverty or spousal abuse or child abuse. These same ills are coming into these Native American villages and destroying what was before a very friendly and cohesive family is now being destroyed by these internal divisions and quarrels and depression, which just leads to apathy and poverty when the clan mothers are intoxicated and can't go out to plant the fields. It creates a famine. When the men won't go out except to hunt so that they can get furs to trade for alcohol, what does that do to a people as a whole? And many of the British people are saying, well, you know, all we have to trade is rum. You came to the fort and I'm sorry, we don't have anything else. All we have is rum. All we have is whiskey. So do you want it or not? It just becomes this total, in my opinion, one of the worst things that Europeans ever did to Native Americans. Long story short, you couple this with the plagues, Haudenosaunee villages at this time is no place to live. Not to depress you guys all, but that doesn't mean that the Haudenosaunee are not still influential powers in North America. And what this war with France has done is it's actually sown the seeds for the American Revolution, which is what we'll be getting to in the future. And we'll set everything up and explain how the Iroquois actually help influence the break from Britain. But before that, we're going to do a few more things this summer, so why don't we talk about that?
That's right, Andrew. We are going to be doing something we've never done before, and we're really looking forward to it within the next month. We are going to be teaming up with another successful podcaster, and we are going to be splitting the show with him, and we'll kind of leave it as a little surprise right now until it gets a little closer.
Some other things we'd like to do this summer is we'd like to do another Legends episode at some point. And also we'd like to do an episode covering Native American games, which I would really be looking forward to. Then we're looking at most likely towards the end of summer or early fall, we'll be getting in and we'll be doing a lengthy series on the Iroquois during the American Revolution. And right now on the drawing board, we're looking at minimum 7 episodes for that.
Yeah, probably most more. Likely will be more. This French and Indian War series we did, it took us, I think we've been working on this for 3.5-4 months. So it'll be at least as long. Most likely it'll be a 6-month project for us. But I think you will all really enjoy it. And I think that Andrew and I will too.
One other thing I wanted to mention is there's another podcast called The Eastern Border. It's hosted by a man named Christops. And he covers Soviet Union style times. And he's a really quirky, fun guy. But I actually co-hosted a show of his. You can search for it. It's called Reservation for Two on the Eastern Border Podcast. And we talk about the relations between Native Americans under American colonialism versus minorities under the Soviet Union and how they both got the short end of the stick.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know, if you ever come across Seeing Dark Myths somewhere, Dark Myths is it's like a podcast guild that Andrew and I are members of with our show. And it's a group, I think they got about 20 different podcasters in it, and they specialize on a storytelling, basically. So if you ever see anybody with a little tag there, that means they're part of the same guild as us. So feel free to give them a listen.
We'd also like to give a very special thank you to Enrique Vallée, who helped us with the French pronunciations in this episode. I'm sure that we still got many of them wrong, but it made it a lot easier to do that. Also, we would like to remind you, please go on iTunes and leave us a review, and you will become a member of the Wild Sweet Potato Clan. If you guys are thinking, well, I don't live in the United States, I don't live in Canada, I've looked at the iTunes store and there's no reviews yet, be a trailblazer. Be a trailblazer. Be the first person in your country to leave a review. Or the second or the third.
Yeah, we don't have any Norwegian reviews yet.
No Norwegian reviews. or Icelandic. We know there's Icelandic listeners because we trend number 45 in history podcasts in Iceland. So I know you're out there. It's probably one guy. But
I think us trading that plug with the Viking podcast probably got us some listeners from Scandinavia. So if you're out there, I want to see a review up.
Don't forget, guys, you can also contact us by email at longhousepodcast.com. Find us on Facebook or on Twitter, hashtag Iroquois History.
Feel free to message us with any questions or concerns. If we are slaughtering a different language in the future, maybe you'll step up like our French-Canadian friend that contacted us.
I'd also like to give a special shout-out. We've had several messages in conversation, one with a Oneida man and a Tuscarora woman, who both said that they enjoyed the show and appreciated what we were doing and liked our style. So that really means a lot coming from you guys. And we will see you all next time.
Bye, everybody.